London is a place with a lot of history. That I figure regular listeners would have figured that out by now. I mean, we're 97 chapters in, and guess what? We've only reached the year 1263. But what I hope that this show has demonstrated is that there were events that were really, really big at the time and that now tend to be overlooked and forgotten about. In this episode, we're looking at some events that were huge at the time, like staggeringly important to the residents of London, so important that many of them were to be killed because of them. But alas, these actions are now almost completely forgotten. This is the story about what is known as the Second Barons' War, a war that was basically bookmarked by just two battles, both of which changed the story of London irrevocably. In this chapter, will be about the first of these, the Battle of Lewes, a medieval fight most famed for the fact that during this battle, the heir to the throne of England, the future King Edward I, ended up costing the battle and losing it because he was so furious at the residents of London. He spent ages leading his men to ride down and kill as many Londoners as possible. In his fury and his utter hatred of the men of the city, Edward took his time to murder as many of them as he could get his hands on. Which begs the question, what the hell did London do? Let's find out, shall we? Hi, my name is Saul, and this is The Story of London, a podcast dedicated to trying to tell the great history of the city as a single narrative tale. And we've reached chapter 97. Bloodstains on the Fields of Lewes. If you were to travel to Sussex in the south of England, you will never be failed to be rewarded by visiting the town of Lewes. It's one of the more fascinating places in the United Kingdom, with some amazing history. But if you're ever there, you could always make your way away from the River Ouse, which runs through the centre of the town, past the area called Wallands Park, and make your way to the outskirts, where you'll find a district known as Mount Harry. There, on the very edge of town, beyond the last of the houses, you'll encounter a large green field sitting before you, nestling on the edge of the Sussex Downs, rising gently away from you. And had you been here on the morning of the 14th of May, 1264, and walked up that hill, you would have seen a most intimidating sight. There, ahead of you, on the high ground, were thousands of men in a long battle line, preparing for a fight. As you walked up that field, you would have probably passed bodies, men whose throats had been cut and bodies left for carrion. Occasionally you'd see bloodstains of injured men who had been slashed and bled and fled. These are the detritus of a small series of opening skirmishes that took place that morning already, as the men on the hill informed the forces of a much larger army stationed in the town behind you that they were here. Before dawn, this force on the hill had awoken about 10 miles north of here, in a village called Fletching, and marched south with purpose. The dead bodies you're stepping around are the early morning foragers and provision gatherers for the enemy, the other army in the town, who had been intercepted by the scouts of this force on the hill and slain and driven off. As you climb up that green field, you notice that the men ahead of you wear hastily sewn, crudely made white crosses made from cloth and linen, and that had been affixed to their uniform, allowing these men to tell which of their men would be theirs in the battle ahead. And if you, as you walked towards this battle line, veered to your right, aiming to the left-hand side of this formation, before you would have been a large body of men, gritting their teeth and preparing for the scrap to come. These were the men from London. Almost all of this whole section were Londoners, men who had lived through the things we've covered in the last 10 chapters or so. They came because they had chosen to come, their city a crucial bastion of this army's supporters. This was, in effect, the Army of London. But upon sight of them, the question must be asked, why are they here? How did they get here? Well, to understand that, we need to go back a few years. London in the early 1260s was a place that was part and parcel of an ongoing political argument gripping the country. The argument was very simple. Who ran England? On paper, the answer was just as simple. The king, Henry III. But into this had been added a complication. A large number of barons had used this newfangled body, the Parliament, to basically make the king a symbolic figurehead. While he ran things in name, the real power was vested in a community of 15 barons and landowners whose job was to simply be not as crap as the king had been, because any way you call it, Henry III had been a rather crap king. But the power of this body of 50 knights had been eroded, they'd fought amongst themselves, and the king had produced an edict from the Pope, which had annulled his promises to basically do what they say. And the country had teetered on the edge of civil war for a while. London had been ordered to be armed. Firstly, under the orders of the Earl of Gloucester, and then by the order of the king. And into this crazy mix, a new mayor had arisen, a man called Thomas FitzThomas. And he had suddenly revolutionised the city. Even though he was one of them by birth and origin, he had ignored the traditional oligarchs of London, seeking support direct from the people. And he had made sure that the people were armed, but also organised. This was a mayor who would seek popular support for the measures he wanted to introduce. And he was the man who was allowing the tradesmen organise themselves, defend their rights and protect their livelihoods. Thomas FitzThomas was a powerful, charismatic mayor. But London was not a peaceful place to be living in. The city was seething with tension, with passion and danger. The city was not fully on one side or another in the immediate build-up to when the fighting started. Partisans for both the king and the barons were to be found, I dare say, along every street. Nothing was cut and dried or black and white. We know that the city was trying to maintain peace to a degree, acting as intermediaries between the sides, like the time, quote, by the king's command, certain of the citizens were sent to Dover with the king's council to treat for peace with the barons, unquote. But their principal concern as a city at this time, and the reason for them being all armed in the first place, was the rather alarming prospect of having lots of armed men in the city who were part of the factions who were falling out. The prospects of a battle on the streets of London, with its massive population, which I've seen one or two historians suggest was as many as 100,000 people around now, I'm not too sure, but the idea of a battle or fighting taking place on those streets was not something anyone wanted to see happen. And around 1262, there was some relief on this front. The records say, quote, at this season, and indeed before, all aliens, both knights and sergeants, were dismissed from the city, who were afterwards placed by Sir Edward in the garrison at Windsor, unquote. So, a big bunch of soldiers and men-at-arms left London, but the city was now filled with its own heavily armed citizenry. And in response to this, quote, the citizens kept watch and ward, riding by night throughout the city, with horse and arms, unquote. So, effectively, London is now under armed lockdown to keep the peace. The armed men were citizens of the city, and they were now riding down Cheapside and Eastcheap and other streets, all within the walls of the place. The peaceful night's sleep of the city was broken by heavy footsteps and the hooves of their neighbours. And of course, this being London in the 13th century, there were bad elements. Having a centralized defense force like this meant that, well, it's hard to keep track of everything. And as one chronicler said, quote, though amongst them a countless multitude of persons on foot obtruded themselves, unquote. Yep, some people use this to become noticeable in an intrusive way. How? Well, the records hint at very dark events. Quote, some evil-minded amongst whom, under pretext of searching for aliens, broke open many houses belonging to other persons and carried off such goods as were to be found, unquote. We have a situation here where armed Londoners are now barging into their neighbours' houses, claiming to be searching for aliens, aka non-London-based residents, and then using this as an excuse to help themselves to anything not nailed down. How very London. This could not be tolerated. Quote, to restrain the evil designs of these persons, the watchers on horseback were therefore put an end to. And watch was kept by respective wards, each person keeping himself well-armed within his own ward, unquote. So every ward watches their own district, and every ward had their own militia, their own community watch. A community watch packing weapons, swords and more. The tensions in the city slowly creep up. The records say that the political moves around them carried on. I mean, we have from this year, quote, and the barons came to London, and on the morrow the king and queen withdrew from the tower to Westminster. At this time, with the assent of his lordship the king, Hugh de Spencer was made by the barons justiciar of all England, and the Tower of London delivered into his charge, unquote. So the king was moving back to where he should be, in Westminster Palace and not in the Tower of London, but to be honest, he'll keep scuttling back there. The tower had been, as we'd mentioned in previous episodes, turned into a proper fortress, a bastion, a safe place for him and his family in the event of a civil war, and tensions remained high. And with the backing of the radical mayor, these tensions spilled into the streets of London again, driven by politics. People started acting against those who seemed to be supportive of the king. And as well as that, people started acting against the Cahosins. You may remember them, I mentioned them a few episodes ago. These were French moneylenders who were disliked by everybody intensely because the terms and conditions they placed on loans they lent out to people were an effective way of charging interest on the loans without saying we're charging interest on the loans. And all of this spilled out onto the streets of London. Quote, for whereas the barons were only fighting against those who wished to break the aforesaid statutes and seize the property of such, and that too by day, the others by night broke into the houses of the people of Quercy, unquote. So this is from a London record, and it says that nighttime vigilantes in London were going after the homes of people from Quercy, which was a town where the Cahosins were said to come from. And not just them, because they're moneylenders, but the reports say that these nighttime mobs were now targeting, quote, other persons in the city who were not against the said statutes, but by main force carried off the property found in such houses, besides doing many other unlawful acts as well, unquote. So what am I describing here? Round about 1262 going into 1263, the neighbourhoods of London are carrying on with their lives by the day while political tensions fill the air with worry and strife. That sense of hysteric paranoia we've been describing over the last few chapters is growing. Armed groups travel into wards looking for supporters of the king or foreigners, like real foreigners, but the wards protected their own streets. Were there standoffs around places like the Steelyard, the area down by the river conceded to the Germanic merchants of London? In the dark, shadow-filled streets, illuminated by torches only, were threats issued, demands made, standoffs happening? No, I cannot say for sure. But it sounds like it, doesn't it? London was turning on London.
And as for the records written by the German-born analyst of the City of the Time, his bias shows when he says that the official response to these groups of self-appointed vigilantes was not as strict as he liked. Quote, as to the mayor, he censured these persons, but in a lukewarm way, unquote. This is a groundswell beginning to run out of control. This is the voiceless of London being given voice. This is them, after years of obeying the yeshivins and the merchants and the bishops and the powerful, now being empowered by a mayor and them finding strength and showing it. Oh, and these rows were not just nighttime raids upon their enemies' homes. There is more to this voice of the voiceless. And there exists one really important description of that era about London that really stands out for me. Quote, afterwards, these same persons, like so many justicars itinerant, wish to remove all perpestures, new and old, observing no order of trial, unquote. Now, perpesture is a wonderful word, one that is nowhere near used enough in our modern day conversation, and that's such a pity. What does it mean? In simplest terms, a perpesture is an obstruction. But a specific type of obstruction. It's an obstruction that encroaches upon places that are in common use, such as a road or a footpath. It's like a gate erected over an alleyway, or a fence cordoning off a seated area outside a cafe for people to have coffee that just goes on that little bit too far into the street. And the thing is, apparently, there were a lot of these to be found in London at this time. And many in London were sick of them. I mean, it makes sense. Before they were wards, the districts of London had been souks, private parcels of land owned often by distant landlords. And in London, you know the tradition, where if you do something a few times, it becomes law more often than not. And so the rich had erected such perpestures all over the place to block off alleyways, to turn the end of a street into a home he could charge rent from, for whatever reason. And yet, no longer could they do this. The Londoners decided to move against these things. Now, it's interesting to note the term used to describe the groups doing this. The analyst, for all his hostility towards them, does not call this group a mob or criminals. He uses the wonderful term justicars itinerant. Juxtaposition suggesting they were acting within the law but without authority to do it technically. As the hostile analyst of London says, these groups, quote, endeavoured to throw open lanes, which by writ of his lordship the king, the community asserting thereto, had been stopped up and rented to certain persons. So much so, in fact, that some of them they opened without judgment given, and in like manner did they remove certain perpestures, and some of them after dinner. And this they did, not only for the purpose of removing them, but for the opportunity of carrying off the timber and other things there to be found, unquote. In between the passive-aggressive phrasing, we get some powerful insights here. Now, some of these blocks had been legally granted, but they knew that they were an imposition. And these new groups didn't seem to care. The people of London had right on their side. Of course, the final accusation of the crowds removing these things to sell the wood could also equally just be as true. I never said Londoners at the time were nice people. And also, this is London. Might be a shame for that wood to go to waste now, wouldn't it? Makes sense to make a tiny bit of profit on the side. There's also a really interesting insight in that description that several of these events took place after dinner, suggesting the people who were doing this, they're workers, men with crafts, cordwainers, say, or skinners, or ironmongers. They get up, go to work, spend their day in their crafts, then come home and have their dinners, and then after dinner, they gather together, go out, find the gate some landlord had built that blocked off a street, and simply remove it, because these streets are ours. And since we know cordwainers and skinners and ironmongers had been amongst the groups who had recently gathered together to form unofficially, officially sanctioned adulterated craft guilds, this suggests all of this was done with the blessing of the radical mayor, Thomas
FitzThomas.
The impression we're getting here is of London beginning to properly stand up for itself. But as I do try and warn regular listeners, this is not always a good thing. The passions of a London mob are a terrible thing. And we did get a hint of this in 1262, when the story goes that a local resident got into an argument with a Jewish resident of the city, supposedly over the amount of interest he was being charged on a loan. This may not actually be true. The cause of the argument may have been over anything. But by the Church of St. Mary Colechurch, the two men came to blows. The Jewish resident of London injured the Christian resident of London. And at that, the blood of the locals was up and the Jewish man was seized by a mob and stabbed to death. And then a riot broke out. The Jewish district of London, the jury, faced a mob who ransacked their homes and attacked any Jewish residents they could find nearby. But while these events were curtailed, there was always that danger that London could turn on its Jewish neighbours. And this was a hint of something terrible to come. So what was going on nationally? Well, the battle lines were being drawn up and the situation was becoming immensely complex. Which means that what now follows is a really useful childless simplification. The king gained the upper hand. He got all the powers that be to agree that disputes between himself and the barons should be sorted by international arbitration. In this case, King Louis of France. But King Louis of France sided with the king most of the time, and this was causing serious resentment. However, as I said, the king held the upper hand, but he was also dependent upon the support of one or two crucial allies, in particular the Earl of Gloucester, who had now come over to his side. But then the Earl of Gloucester died, and his son went and joined the side of the more militant barons. And then by April 1263, Simon de Montfort, aka Simon de Montfort, returned to England to take charge of the dissenting barons. And really, the fighting began. Away in Wales, supporter of the barons attacked supporters of the king. Simon moved his forces out of Oxford and struck westward, aiming to secure command of the Severn River and his communications with these supporters in Wales. He hardly met any opposition, the West mostly being against the king. Gloucester and Bristol opened their gates to him. He permitted his followers to extract tribute from those royalists they encountered. Fields were burned and livestock seized. The war had begun in earnest. Simon de Montfort now proceeded to show what kind of leader he was. He was not about long sieges waiting for other barons to get off their asses and join him. He seemed to know that momentum was key to this war. And he seemed to have, very early on, two core objectives. Control the cinque ports of Kent and control London. As always, control of the largest city of the land was paramount. Quickly after consolidating in the west, he turned and marched towards London with a speed that threw the king and his advisers into confusion. But he surprised many by not marching on London. Rather, he swung south after Windsor and went straight into Kent. The sudden speed and dynamism of the war caused King Henry to panic, and he took shelter again behind the strong walls of the Tower of London. And then something happened. London sided with the barons. The exact reason is a combination of things. We'll start with, we read from London-based sources at the time. Quote, "This year, Thomas FitzThomas was again elected mayor by the populace, the aldermen and the principal men of the city being but little consulted thereon. And immediately after the election, he was sworn, as he had been the two preceding years, a thing no other mayor had ever been, unless he'd been first admitted to the king or his barons and the exchequer," unquote. Thomas FitzThomas begins his third year in power, appealing to the mass of Londoners, not the oligarchs. Now, that international arbitration where the French king had sided with King Henry, that had annoyed a lot of people. And we read clearly also that year, quote, "The Londoners, however, and the barons of the cinque ports, and nearly all the middle classes of the people throughout the Kingdom of England, who indeed had not joined in the reference to the King of France, wholly declined his award," unquote. Supposedly, nearly all the middle class in England, aka anybody not a noble and not a peasant in the field, was not maybe fully supportive of Simon de Montfort, the Earl of Leicester, but we're saying they have issues with the French king's proclamations and everything, and they're leaning that way heavily. And we're talking about urban dwellers. And crucially, this is London and the Cinque Ports, the south coast ports, with both these places have strong mercantile elements in them, and above all, guess where Simon de Montfort was aiming for? So, 1263, and the Civil War really begins in earnest. The king shut himself up in the Tower, and although he wasn't attacked, effectively, he's kind of in a state of siege. And then events really quickly spiraled out of control. Now, in the exact sequence of what follows, I'm going to present them as my interpretation of a linear sequence of events that makes sense to me. My bias is based on treating London, the city, like it's a person. And so looking at the events I have, I read them and how they are explained by others, and I see how it makes sense given everything I've said about the city so far. So you're about to hear me describe event A, which led to event B, which caused event C, and then led to D, etc., etc., in order. Please note, I have read some historians who will say that, say, C happened first, and then B, and then led to D, and others who will say D happened first, and then A, and I suppose it really doesn't matter. The events all happen. But this is me reminding you that I present things as a narrative. So in the story you're about to hear, this is how I think the story went. But I'll alert you to this fact and point out that better historians could turn around and say, actually, you've got the order wrong. I leave that to them to correct me. For the purpose of the story of London, then, events started to spiral out of control around June 19th, 1263, when Prince Edward, the son of the king, arrived in the London region with his forces. He'd been leading these men trying to cover the fighting in Wales, but he was lacking in funds needed to hold them together, suggesting there was a mercenary element to them. Edward needed cash urgently. He was not going to attack the city. London was bristling with armed men, as we said. But Prince Edward actually wasn't aiming for London. He was coming up by the River Thames, but he sailed his men up beyond Westminster, but then had his boats land by the orchards and the grounds off the Templar headquarters, the building that was effectively the Bank of London. Edward arrived at the new temple, where his mother's jewels were being held as security for loans she had received. The story goes that Edward presented himself with a bodyguard and declared that he just wanted to be assured that his mother's jewels were safe. Recognising the legitimacy of his request, the prince was escorted back into the centre of the great cluster of buildings which constituted the new temple until they came to the vaults. And it was here that Edward and the men with him then forcefully took possession of the keys and proceeded to help themselves. He wasn't just after his mother's jewels. It was reported that Prince Edward stole a massive £10,000 worth of coin and gems, most of which belonged to London merchants. Now, the idea may be that he was inspired in doing this by events in London recently. If you remember a couple of chapters ago, I mentioned how baronial authorities had seized the funds from the Templar headquarters that they suggested as belonged to the Lusignan in-laws of the king. Prince Edward may have seen this as nothing more than a tit for tat, a simple retaliation of a previous deed. London, however, did not see it that way. £10,000 worth of collateral, all from Londoners. They saw this as a gross violation, a truly unforgivable crime. The city exploded in fury and rage. But they could not storm the Tower of London, nor take arms against the rapidly retreating troops of Prince Edward as they sailed downriver to Windsor. So what could they do? Well, when news arrived at the city of the perfidy of Prince Edward,
the audacity of his theft and the explosion of rage over in the Tower of London, the royal party still there began to get worried. And it was decided it would be best if the Queen would leave to get herself to Windsor in safety. So she took a boat to sail her from the Tower of London downriver to Windsor. Now, at this time, the royal barge she would have taken was a type of galley, slow, designed to proceed gracefully and in comfort, not built for speed. Typically, such boats had a large square mainsail of coloured cloth, may even be silk, and there was a small cavern above the level of the rowers. Ordinarily, the royal standard would fly from the prow. Yet, as this ponderous craft left its moorings by the Tower of London, every pair of eyes in the city saw it. Now, they were used to seeing this craft ply the waters of the Thames, filled with minstrels making music and brightly dressed members of the Queen's court. They knew exactly who was in that boat. The mother of the bastard who just stole 10 grand from London. Queen Eleanor of England was 41 years of age. She had been suffering from ill health for some years, but she still presented a majestic and rather formidable appearance. And yet, as she was rowed out of the Tower of London that day, all the majesty in the world would not have protected her from the hail of abuse coming towards her from the riverbank. London started insulting her, screaming vitriolic barbs towards the boat. And then she saw her obvious issue. Ahead of her stood a problem. London Bridge. 300 yards long, and even though it was lined with houses and shops, it provided plenty of room for spectators. The bridge was suddenly packed with Londoners as the barge slowly navigated itself into the river and steered for one of the narrow arches through which the water roiled and churned. A chorus of hate and insults arose as soon as it became certain that this was the Queen and her lady seeking to escape the tower. So intense in their fury were they that the residents reached for rotten eggs, vegetables, for dried mud, for stones and loose pieces of paving. They reached for human shit. I read one report that the Queen and her ship was pelted with these things and worse. One book I read said the insults said to her were things like, "Down with the witch," and "Drown the witch," and they could well have been. And by themselves, this is probably what could have been the greatest insults the Queen had ever received in her entire life. But I think I would not be too far off the mark to suggest that amidst these was probably much more colourful language. As the Queen Consort of England slowly made her way towards London Bridge, she would have been met with a vast bombardment of insults, both crude and graphic, about her, her husband the king, her bloody thieving son, and this would have been joined as hundreds, if not possibly thousands of residents began to throw things at her barge. Hard shit. Eggs. Stones. The reality was, this barge had to sail under London Bridge, under this barrage, and then slowly emerge on the other side. Yeah, that wasn't going to work. The order was given to turn around. It's said that the Queen's response to this was fury, that she disliked the residents of London more than anyone else on earth. And maybe that's true, but do not tell me she was not terrified also. The Queen retreated. The rowers, hauling against the tide, dragged her back to the tower, no doubt to the catcalls and roars of the Londoners watching. Keep in mind, in time, news of this would have reached her son in Windsor. London did this to his mother. To his mother, Edward, Prince of England, future King of England, remembered this day. It would burn in him. It would burn the heart of him. On that day, London gained a most ferocious enemy.
And for these reasons, London, under its radical mayor, was now siding with Simon de Montfort, the leader of the barons. The die was cast. If there was to be a war, then London knew which side it was on. To be blunt, it was obviously going that way anyway. Edward's actions wouldn't have made much difference. And to give them their due, London did calm down some. It's later reported that the Queen was able to go by foot, with an armed escort, from the Tower to St. Paul's to find sanctuary there briefly. And we see no reports of vitriol or fury. But again, the sources are vague. But war was here, and London rose itself from its long slumber to bear its sword of Mars again. And the call to war was that had been long before, the sound of the war bell ringing over the city. Quote, "Wherefore, the Londoners appointed one of their number, Thomas de Pewillisden by name, to be their constable, and as marshal, Stephen Buckerel, at whose summons, upon hearing the great bell of St. Paul's, all the people of the city were to sally forth, and not otherwise, being prepared as well by night as well as by day, and well armed to follow the standards of the said constable and marshal, wheresoever they might think proper to lead them," unquote. Ah, the bells. The bells that had summoned London to fight the Empress Matilda still rang out to tell London to gather together to bear arms. And there was a surname we've seen many times before. A Buckerel was leading the armed forces of London. Ah, the ghosts of London's past haunt even 13th century London. And these armed forces did not wait long for action. The royal party, the king, the queen and the supporters had left London by now. And, quote, "After this, Hugh de Spencer, the justiciar, who then had charge of the Tower, with a countless multitude of Londoners, went forth from the city, following the standards of the aforesaid constable and marshal, none of them knowing whether they were going or what they were to do. Being led, however, as far as Isleworth, where they laid waste and ravaged with fire the manor of the King of Germans, and plundered all the property there found, and broke down and burned his mills and fish preserves, observing no truce, and at the very time that the said Parliament was in existence. And this was the beginning of woes and the source of that deadly war through which so many manors were committed to the flames, so many men, rich and poor, were plundered, and so many thousands of persons lost their lives," unquote. So yeah, the army of London travelled southwest of London to the estates of Richard, Earl of Cornwall, the king's brother, who was nominally at this time the king of the Germans, and they burned his estates and his manor house, scorched earth, right now. London style. Records indicate the die was more than cast, and in fact formal agreements were made. Quote, "At this time the barons and Londoners entered into a league by written instrument and by oath, all in fact of 12 years of age and upwards, to the effect that they would stand together against all men," unquote. It's like the First Barons' War, and the events that took place around the signing of the Magna Carta. London was now the centre of a radical baronial-led insurrection. So now the alliance between de Montfort's forces and London was all formal. De Montfort's followers now entered London properly. And this immediately caused a terrible event to happen. Because de Montfort was many things, but he was also the son of a crusader who had died in battle, a crusader himself, and he and his men were slightly more right-wing than Attila the Hun. His forces contained a lot of hardcore Christian bigots, and now they were residing within London. The result was horrific. Quote, "Afterwards, in the week before Palm Sunday, the Jewry in London was destroyed, and all the property of the Jews carried off, as many of them were found being stripped naked, despoiled and afterwards murdered by night in sections, to the number, that is to say, of more than 500. And as for those who survived, they were saved by the justiciars and the mayor, having been sent to the Tower before the slaughter took place," unquote. More than 500 Jews murdered on the streets of London in what was, by all accounts, a systemic and methodical attack. They came for them at night. In sections, it says. And the term, quote, as many of them were found, unquote, is especially chilling. This was not, as some have suggested, a spontaneous drunken riot, an outpouring of just latent anti-Semitic feelings spurned on by alcohol and bad feeling. This was planned. This was a military operation. This was a pogrom. Call it for what it was, the London pogrom of 1264. The community was not wiped out, far from it. It was to survive, its synagogues reborn. And those lucky ones, the mayor and the justicars, and we don't know if that refers to the formal justicars or the justicars itinerant, but they were able to get a warning to some. And it appears as if the forces of de Montfort had decided to strike out against the supporters of the king as they saw it. And as always, Jews were designated supporters of the king. And so that was their excuse. And that was that. The horror of that pogrom. Of victims stripped naked, despoiled, and afterwards murdered is all we need to understand the sheer brutality of that night. And yet it was also part of a larger campaign directed by de Montfort, because in the same sentence as this moment is mentioned, we read, quote, and then also, as well as before, much money belonging to the men of Italy and to Quercy, which had been deposited in the priories and abbeys around London for safe custody, was dragged forth and carried off to London, unquote. So yeah, they were going after all the moneylenders' money, not just Jewish ones, Italians and French, but it should be noted, they were going after the moneylenders' money. They were just killing the Jews. Yet there was no dwelling on this. The men of London under Marshal Bucquerel were to see action soon after. As records say, quote, afterwards, in the week before Easter, the barons and the Londoners attacked Rochester and took it, and laying siege to the castle there, took the bailey. But on hearing news of the king's approach, they withdrew and returned to London in Easter week, unquote. So again, men of London are marching out, and fall this time upon one of their traditional battlefields, Rochester. Oh, déjà vu. Yet the royal forces were not standing still. Seeing the need to secure the Cinque Ports, Henry and his son began assembling a large force in Kent in the southeast, seeking to regain the military advantage. And this is why the siege of Rochester was pulled away. And all of this was going on just before we read in the records of London, quote, after this, on the feast of St. John Port-Laty, the barons and the Londoners went forth from the city to meet his said lordship the king, who is then in the neighbourhood of Lewes, with a very great force, unquote. That is how we ended up here in Lewes. So here we are, in that field above the town, stood with the men of London. Now, de Montfort's entire force numbered about 5,000 or so, give or take. And the royal forces down below outnumbered them at least 2-1. And down below, the royal army is mustering, gathering its might. Now, I could have talked for the entire episode just about the Battle of Lewes. Whole books have been written by military historians whose passion for detail about every aspect of the battle and their skills far superior to my own. But to be blunt, I've already said the outcome. We know what is to come. Everything I say from now on will only be a brutal summary of the events needed to tell the story of London. The most obvious thing, however, that grabs our attention is the mistake of Simon de Montfort. Having gained the tactical initiative, and after choosing particularly good ground to place his army in, de Montfort then waited, handing the first move back to the king, allowing the king respond to organise his forces instead of just attacking them as they slept. Why? Well, I agree with the historians who suggest that partly Simon de Montfort felt he had enough forces to make such a show of strength that his brother-in-law, the not very military king, would offer terms to him. And if that failed, he was in a good defensive position, the high ground. So that's the reason why he marched here and then held. But what's important to note is that while de Montfort's army was mostly infantry, there was a hell of a lot of cavalry in the Royal Army in the town. And this was to be a crucial factor in the battle ahead. So here we stand with the forces of London. Well, the city's armed forces, now in their third expedition from London, was led by Marshal Bucquerel. At this battle, command of this part of the battle line was given to Nicholas de Seagrave of Leicestershire, later officially recognised Baron Seagrave. De Seagrave was a young knight, a year older than Prince Edward, and he had defended Northampton against the king's forces. He'd escaped capture when that town was taken, and he'd fled to London. He had joined the London army at the Siege of Rochester, and had been made noble captain of the London foot contingent through popular acclamation. Nicholas took the field of Lewes with the left ward under overall command of the Earl of Oxford, but him in charge of this London group. He was 26 years old. The force around him were a mixture of men with spears and archers, mostly men with spears, the infantry of the city, mass gathered and bunched up, formed on the high ground atop Lewes Downs, nearest the chalk pits. And luckily, directly in front of London soldiers, was the cream of the Royalist army, the overwhelming ranks of knights, sergeants, and squires off the cavalry, some 2,500 horsemen. Now, one thing that's obvious to everyone in that long battle line, they could see everything the Royalist army was doing. And as this huge body of cavalry assembled before the Londoners, it's worth noting de Montfort did nothing to aid them. Why? Well, I think it's a valid question. Why did de Montfort allow the contingent from London face such a large mass of horse? I tend to concur with those historians who suggested the reason the Londoners thought they could face a possible charge of the cavalry of the Royalist army was because they figured to themselves they could hold, they could take it. See, there's not that many books on infantry tactics of the 13th century, believe it or not, I could find, and the base idea would have been the same now as it had been back in the Battle of Hastings. If you build a strong shield wall, put yourself on good high ground, stick out a lot of spears, a large body of infantry may well have absorbed a cavalry charge. But there's one extra factor in this. That cavalry force down there, it was being led by Prince Edward, and Edward hated the Londoners. He and his men were motivated to attack them. But I think it's fair to consider that, given everything, London hated Edward right back. He was, it could be argued, a filthy little thief. Sod him. Let him come. Let's be straight. Being infantry and holding in the face of a cavalry charge requires confidence in one another and in the strength of arms which a city levy may not have had without the additional support of improvised field defences. So maybe they had tried to erect spikes. Maybe. Like, we know the army arrived at first light. We know they took the Royalist army by surprise. And then we know they waited. They didn't attack. We also know that the flank in front of the Londoners was gentler than the flank round the centre and the right of their battle line, making this ground particularly vulnerable to a mounted assault. Given this is where precisely the Royalist cavalry formed up and attacked, and given that de Montfort had all this time in the world to watch the Royalist horse assembling, it does suggest to me that de Montfort and the Londoners knew exactly where they wanted to be. They were going to stick themselves here, make a big shield wall, stick out their spears, but also drive spikes into the ground, so to give themselves extra cover and protection. And I think that, even though that may have been the plan and that was why the Londoners had set up here, I think they realised they had an issue. The region was then and still is a thin topsoil over chalk, which makes it excellent ground for horses to charge upon, but really, really bad for defenders to dig pits and erect spikes to face those horses. Now, we know from future battles very soon in the future against the Scots and the French, infantry like to erect such spikes. So I admit I'm being a tad speculative, but it just makes sense to me that they would have if they could have, and they planned to, but when they set up, they discovered the ground itself was working against them. And by the time they realised this,
It was too late. The Londoners had agreed to be bait for Edward's cavalry, but the setup was not going ideally. But still, this Army of London was not some straightforward peasant levy. It was an urban-based militia, and may well have had a good number of experienced soldiers and ex-mercenaries from foreign wars or the Welsh conflicts in their ranks. It is probable that most of these men would have higher than average access to body armour, such as padded gambesons or even mail. And they would have been spirited and motivated. But then again, so was Prince Edward. So, what happened? Well, we know that as the Royalist army was still assembling, before his father could organise his forces, Edward ordered his heavy cavalry to attack the bloody Londoners. Hate means hate. They stoned his mother? Bastards have it coming. And on those chalk downs, this vast body of cavalry thundered across the green, up the slope, and smashed into the London forces facing him with fury and rage and bloody intent. And we know that London's forces broke. But we know little else. And in particular, we don't know if it was just one charge that broke the London line. I mean, it may have been several charges. If the Londoners' morale and self-confidence was high enough, then it may have taken several attempts, or at least some time, before the cohesion of those men was lost. And indeed, they may have given considerable ground before they broke, holding together under relentless attack of the young prince, his hatred of them matched by mutual hatred straight back at them. The Londoners may have held on because, you know, it just took one of them, just one of them, to get a lucky blow in, and that bloody bastard Edward would be dead. It's worth it. It's so worth it. But Edward feels the same about London. These arrogant, good-for-nothing shitheads, they dared to say those things about my mother, the Queen. In my head, the fighting actually didn't go on one charge. It lasts for some time. It didn't take 10 charges either, but it was relentless and it was savage. And after several charges, I think, the men of London broke. The Londoners routed. Yet this rout would not have been a quick thing either. I like to imagine groups of seasoned veterans and lifelong comrades sticking together, forming dispersed attempts at some kind of organised defence. Because the truth is, running on foot with your back to some bloodthirsty knights on horseback is basically suicide by bloodthirsty knights on horseback. And everyone knew this. So from a knight's point of view, it was great fun and dead easy to ride down panic-stricken and defenceless infantrymen. But if those bastards are trying to regroup in units of tens or maybe even hundreds, then the knights would have to rely on their training and a series of grouping together, charging and regrouping by the Royalist horsemen may have been needed to ensure the irrevocable destruction of these Londoners. History has long since damned Prince Edward for allowing his hatred of the men of London affect his control of the cavalry. But that image and reputation damage only works if we imagine that the Londoners just broke at the first charge and the rest was Edward riding around and picking off strays. The moment you consider that that isn't true, then everything that follows is up for question. It could have well been a savage little battle within a battle, and Edward may have been drawn away deliberately by the Londoners. We alas are only given a simplistic account of the battle from monastic scribes who have no real knowledge of precisely what occurred on that flank other than the Londoners were routed and the horse units returned too late. But behind these two unavoidable facts are a number of possibilities. It is possible that some of de Montfort's reserve were committed to keeping the Royalist cavalry from flanking the rest of his army. Simon de Montfort may have not had enough strength to beat Edward's cavalry, but given their commitment against the Londoners, de Montfort just needed only to delay them, separating them long enough for his unimpeded downhill rush on the king's confused uphill advance. And so the Londoners under Nicholas de Segeve gave way to the mounted might of Royalist arms, routing from the field and were pursued for miles.
And that's where the idea that Edward missed the woods from the trees come in. The Londoners' defence, the rout, lasted for miles. Whatever did happen, we know that Prince Edward did spend a lot of time killing our Londoners. And as such, the city dwellers suffered by the end of the day horrendous casualties. They suffered more than anyone else. The Londoners who had marched out, whatever their stories or their tales, had been butchered. And yet they had won. Because when Edward and his cavalry did return to the battlefield, it was over. His father, the king, was captured. His uncle was captured. The leading nobles on his side were captured. It was over. Prince Edward surrendered himself. And while decimated, at least decimated, and perhaps even worse, by their sacrifice, the men of London had swayed the battle. By their sacrifice, finally, Henry III was beaten. London had paid a heavy price, but London was on the winning side. And by the blood that stains the fields of Lewis, London had paid the price needed to enter a brave new world. But what kind of world was it to be? Cover that next episode. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. Story of London exists as a podcast that is supported entirely by listener donations. I really want to thank all the listeners who make occasional donations to the Buy Me a Coffee page. And that allows us to keep going and cover our fees for another month, and it really is appreciated. And I'd also like to thank my most recent contributor, Zosifa, for her lovely comments on Buy Me a Coffee. It's really appreciated. And the donation will come in handy. However, if you want to show support but don't want to give cash, I fully appreciate that. So you can just leave a 5-star review, say, or if you want, actually write a nice review if you're on Apple. And that does help, because it really does impress the automatic algorithms that allow podcasts like mine get a wider audience. Anyway, I'll be back again for chapter 98 of this story, as we rapidly approach our 100th episode. Thanks for listening. Bye.